Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, what do people say about writer Lindy West? Actor and writer Lena Dunham said, quote, "Lindy West is an essential and hilarious voice for women. Her talent and bravery have made the internet a place I actually want to be," unquote. This American Life's Ira Glass calls her, quote, "a totally entertaining and original writer," unquote. And then there are the internet trolls, about whom as little as possible should be said. As you may have heard, West has a memoir out. The title is Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. In it, she tells in no uncertain terms, with profane honesty, the story of her life and struggles coming of age in a culture hostile to women in general and fat women in every mean-spirited particular. Lindy West spoke to a rapturous Town Hall Seattle audience on May 25th. We're presenting the core of her talk here. You can hear the full program, including questions and answers, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. This event was presented by Town Hall and University Bookstore as part of the Arts and Culture series. Thanks to Anna Sophia Knauf for our recording. Please note, this talk contains unedited language of an adult nature.
So, wow. You know, when I was leaving my house to come here, I said to my husband, I'm a little nervous. You know, my other readings, because I'm sort of halfway through this tour, and my other readings have been like, you know, 30, 40, 50 people. And I said, you know, this is going to be like 800 people. And he was like, 700. It's fine. And then we got here, and they were like, oh, no, it's 1,200. It's like, they're like, yeah. Which is, I'm pretty sure that's the most number of people. That's the highest number of people that has ever existed. So, anyway, I don't really know how to express my gratitude to all of you for being here, but it's unbelievably moving, and I'm going to ramble for a minute, and then I'm going to read for a little bit, and then we're going to talk as friends, and then we're going to sign books. Does that sound like a good plan? All right. So I started this book about a year ago, and it was a really long, difficult, scary, solitary process because I didn't know if I knew how to write a book. I mean, I knew that I didn't know how to write a book because, you know, the longest thing I'd written before that was maybe 5,000 words, maybe probably more like 2,000. And a book, FYI, is 80,000, which is a lot of words. And they just sort of turn you loose, and they say, okay, send us a book later, which is scary. And so I ended up just spending a lot of time alone in my house and in other people's houses that they kindly let me use. I went to a cabin in Maine, and I was very alone for about a month with only the family of bats living in the wall to keep me company, which when you're already afraid of ghosts, it's not fun. They're not good friends, actually, good companions at all, because because they're in the wall, and then just imagine the worst noise and then double it, and that's the noise that a bat in the wall makes behind your head when you're sleeping in a 200-year-old farmhouse in Maine in the middle of nowhere. So, but it was an amazing experience in its own way, and it was beautiful, and I wrote a lot of good book there, so that was good. But yeah, so this is a memoir, which means it's a bunch of stuff from my life, and when you're just writing a bunch of stuff from your life alone in a bat-haunted cabin in Maine, you kind of forget that someday 1,200 people are going to read it. 1,200 people, hopefully minimum, and hopefully more than that. And now I'm sort of reckoning with that, you know, I made this thing, and it's very, very vulnerable and very personal in a way that I don't usually write. And now I send it out into the world, and a bunch of strangers read it and then form an opinion on it, which is weird. Because it's like your innermost secrets and most traumatizing, embarrassing moments turned into a book for strangers to judge. So I've just been so amazed and honored by the response, which has been tremendously kind. And I don't know how it happened, but seems like people across the board have found things that they can relate to in this book. And I just feel so grateful to get to do this work. And I feel really grateful that my publisher let me write this weird book, which is full of butts and periods and gross things that if you read the Amazon reviews are very vulgar and people did not want to know about, apparently. But Hachette, my publisher, not only let me write it and put it out into the world, they let me present it, you know, just as a piece of literature, which is the way that the minutiae of men's lives gets presented as literature. And I think that... it really means a lot to me that I get to bring this to you not as a niche publication, but as a book. It's a piece of literature, and it's not a... I mean, it's about women's lives, because it's about my life, specifically. FYI, in case you just wandered in. And I think that's really tremendously important. I think it's... I wrote it about myself, and hopefully to connect with other women and make other women feel less alone. But also, as an entertaining piece of, you know, media for... media is such a horrible jargony. Never mind. It's some content that I created. You know, I think it's a funny book. It's a funny story, and I hope that all people can read it and find something to hang on to, because I really think that I have spent a lot of my life learning about the day-to-day lived experiences of men through literature, and it's been great. But I would love to start having that be a little bit more reciprocal in terms of what we think of as literature and what we incorporate into the canon, and because that's where empathy comes from. And you know, I really... one of my express goals, and this is in the book proposal from a million years ago, is to create a really compelling, funny, engaging, humanized portrait of one funny, feminist, fat woman, because a lot of people don't think that they like loud, funny, feminist, fat women. They don't like it at all. But of course... that's silly, because I'm great and you should like me. So, you guys, you shouldn't let me manipulate you like that. I'm embarrassed by that. Okay. So, I'm gonna actually just read you the first chapter, which I wrote kind of later on in the process, and didn't really realize until I started doing this tour and started doing interviews about the book that it's kind of the mission of the book. This is about growing up and not seeing myself represented in media and not having characters on TV and in the movies that I felt I could relate to and that reflected myself back to me. And so it's about that and how that affected my life and a list of what was available to me, which is slim and not great. And so it not only critiques that idea, but I hope that the book itself is that, you know, becomes that thing that was missing for me. I hope to be something that younger women can look to as, you know, I don't want to say as a role model, but, you know, at least, like, I exist, and I'm a human being, and here I am. You know, I wish that I... I just wrote something that I could have used 15 or 20 years ago. So, are you guys ready? Okay. Ah, so weird to read your book out loud in front of 1,200 people. I love you guys, though, so much. Okay. Why is "what do you want to be when you grow up" the go-to small talk we make with children? Hello, child. As I have run out of compliments to pay you on your doodling, can you tell me what sort of niche you plan to carve out for yourself in the howling existential morass of uncertainty known as the future? Also, has anyone given you a heads up that everyone you love will die someday? That's like waking a dog up with an air horn and telling it that it's president now. I don't know, Uncle Jeff. I'm still kind of working on figuring out how to handle these weird popsicles with the two sticks. It's a horrible popsicle design, by the way. Do they still make those where you have to break the popsicle in half? Abolish it. That actually, I've changed the main message of the book. That's now my main message. There was a time when I was very small that I had a ready response to the question. The answer was ballerina, or for a minute, veterinarian, as I had been erroneously led to believe that veterinarian was the grown-up term for professional animal petter. I would later learn, crestfallen and appalled, that it's more a term for touching poo all the time, featuring intermittent cat murder. So the plan was abandoned. The fact that any kid wants to be a veterinarian is bananas, by the way. Whoever does veterinary medicine's PR among preschool-aged children should be working in the fucking White House. That period, when I was wholly myself, effortlessly certain, my identity still undistorted by the magnetic fields of culture, was so long ago that it's beyond readily accessible memory. I do not recall being that person. For as long as I can recall, any time I met a new adult who would inevitably get nervous, because what is a child and how do you talk to it, and fumble for that same hacky stock question, my imagination would come up empty. Doctor? Too gross. Fireman? Too hard. Princess? Those are fictional, right? Astronaut? LOL. While we're interrogating childhood cliches, who decided that astronaut would be a great dream job for a kid? It's like 97% math, 1% breathing some Russian dude's farts, 1% dying, and 1% eating awesome powdered ice cream. If you're the very luckiest kind of astronaut ever, your big payoff is that you get to visit a barren, airless wasteland for 5 minutes, do some more math, and then go home. Ice cream not even guaranteed. Anyway, loophole, I can already buy astronaut ice cream at the Science Center. No math or dying required. Lindy won, astronauts, nada. Not that it mattered anyway. Astronaut was never on the table. Good luck convincing a fat kid that they should pursue a career in floating. Thanks to a glut of cultural messaging, I knew very clearly what I was not. Small, thin, pretty, girlish, normal, weightless, Winona Ryder. But there was precious little media telling me what I was, what I could be. For me, what do you want to be when you grow up was subsumed by a far more pressing question. What are you? As a kid, I never saw anyone remotely like myself on TV, or in the movies, or in video games, or at the children's theater, or in books, or anywhere at all in my field of vision. There simply were no young, funny, capable, strong, good, fat girls. A fat man can be Tony Soprano, he can be Dan from Roseanne, still my number one celeb crush. He can be John Candy, funny without being a human sight gag. But fat women were sexless mothers, pathetic punchlines, or gruesome villains. Don't believe me? It's cool. I wrote it down. Here is a complete list of fat female role models available in my youth. Lady Cluck. Lady Cluck was a loud, fat chicken woman who took care of Maid Marian in Disney's Robin Hood. Lady Cluck was so fat, in fact, that she was nearly the size of an adult male bear. Okay. You guys can picture her next to Baloo, right? You know that a chicken is not the size of a bear, okay? I'm just saying there's some zoological inaccuracies in that movie. Being a 400-pound chicken, she wasn't afraid to throw down a... Sorry. This is going to take a year to get through this chapter if I keep laughing at my own jokes. Being a 400-pound chicken, she wasn't... And that's a conservative estimate. I looked up bear weights. That's like if he's like the smallest kind of bear. Actually, you know what I did is I looked up what kind of bear it likely was in the Jungle Book, which is where Baloo came from. I know that we'll get to this in a minute. I know that Baloo is not Little John. It's fine. But he is. Anyway, it's a sloth bear, which weigh about 400 pounds. Okay. Being a 400-pound chicken, she wasn't afraid to throw down in a fight with a lion and a gay snake, even though the lion was her boss. Hashtag lean in. And she had Monstro jugs, but in a maternal sexless way, which is a total ripoff. Like, she doesn't even get to have a plus-sized fuck. I can't say it. Okay, this sentence that I wrote in a book says, like, she doesn't even get to have a plus-sized fuck fest with Baloo. Sorry, Mom. Okay. And then it says, then there's a footnote that says, I know that this bear's name is technically Little John, but Little John is clearly a character being played by a bear actor named Baloo, who also played himself in the Jungle Book and decades later, yet seemingly unaged in Tailspin. Okay. Next. Well, okay. All right. Pipe down. Baloo again. More Baloo. Baloo dressed as a sexy fortune teller. Okay. In order to assist Robin Hood in ripping off Prince John's bejeweled decadence caravan, Baloo adorns himself with scarves and rags and golden bangles and whirls around like an impish scirocco, utterly beguiling PJ's guard rhinos and incapacitating them with boners. Baloo dressed as a sexy fortune teller. This is also, you guys know what I'm talking about. It's fine. Baloo dressed as a sexy fortune teller, luxuriates in every curve of his huge, sensuous, bare butt. Self-consciousness is not in his vocabulary. He knows he looks good. The most depressing thing I realized while making this list is that Baloo dressed as a sexy fortune teller is the single most positive role model of my youth. The Queen of Hearts. I do not even know this bitch's deal. Her only personality trait is likes the color red. She doesn't seem to do any governing aside from executing minors from losing at croquet. And she is married to a 1 foot tall baby with a mustache. She is, now that I think about it, the perfect feminazi caricature. Fat, loud, irrational, violent, overbearing, constantly hitting a hedgehog with a flamingo. Okay, that sexual tree from The Last Unicorn. This is a generational thing that some people don't know what this is, but just go with it, okay? This fine lady was just minding her biz, being a big purple tree, when Schmendrick the garbage sorcerer came along and accidentally witchy-pooed her into a libidinous granny. Then he's all mad when she nearly smothers him between her massive oaken cans. Hey man, if you didn't want to get motorboated to death by a fat tree, you should have picked something thinner and hotter to transform into your girlfriend, like a spaghetti noodle or clarinet. The sex tree that launched 1,000 confusing fetishes taught me that fat women's sexuality isn't just ludicrous, it's also suffocating, disgusting, and squelchy. Okay. You guys are going to get so mad at me for this next one, but we're just going to power through and then move on with our lives. Miss Piggy. Okay. I am deeply torn on Piggy. For a lot of fat women, Piggy is it. She is powerful and uncompromising, assertive in her sexuality, and wholly self-possessed, with an ostentatious glamour usually denied anyone over a size 4. Her being a literal pig affords fat fans the opportunity to reclaim that barb with defiant irony. She invented glorifying obesity. Okay, but also, you guys, Miss Piggy is kind of a rapist. Like, maybe if you love Kermie so much, you should respect his bodily autonomy. The dude is physically running away from you. It makes me really uncomfortable. That is just really honest from the heart, and it was hard to write, and I'm sorry. Every plot line is Kermie running, and it's fine. Don't worry. It's fine. You don't have to agree. You shouldn't chase someone physically to have sex with them. It's a bad sign. Okay. If you have to chase them. Okay. And you know how Kermie runs too? It's like, he's like frantic. He's terrified. Okay. Which is also was not a great thing to absorb as a child. Like, oh, this is how men will react to you. Okay, cool. Or frogs, but you know. Okay. Okay, Marla Hooch. A League of Their Own is a classic family comedy that mines the age-old question, what if women could do things? You guys are so cute. Okay. Specifically, the women of A League of Their Own are doing baseball. And Marla Hooch is the most baseball-doingest woman of them all. She can hit homies and run bases and throw the ball far, all while maintaining a positive attitude and dodging jets of Tom Hanks's hot urine. There's just a scene where he pees for a long time. It's fine. It's fine if you guys didn't watch A League of Their Own 400,000 times as a child. The only problem is that she is not max bangable like the other baseball women. She has a jukebox-like body and makes turtle face anytime she is addressed, which, if you think about it, makes her not that good at baseball after all. Fortunately, at the end, she meets a man who is also a jukebox turtle face, and they get married in a condescending ass ceremony that's like, aw, look, the uglies thinks it's people. Presumably they also like each other's personality. What? Doesn't matter? Quarantine the less attractive? Kay. The thing about Marla Hooch is that the actress who plays her is just a totally nice-looking regular woman. I always think of this thing Rachel Dratch said in her memoir, quote, I am offered solely the parts that I like to refer to as the unfuckables. In reality, if you saw me walking down the street, you wouldn't point at me and recoil and throw up and hide behind a shrub. End quote. Hollywood's beauty standards are so wacko that they trick you into thinking that anyone who isn't Gina Davis is literally a toilet. The neighbor with the arm flab from The Adventures of Pete and Pete. Big Pete and Little Pete spent an entire episode fixated on the jiggling of an elderly neighbor's arm fat. Next, I didn't wear a tank top for 20 years. Ursula the Sea Witch. The whole thing with Ariel's voice and Prince Ambien overdose is just an act of civil disobedience. What Ursula really wants is to bring down the regime of King Triton so she and her eel bros don't have to live in a dank hole tending their garden of misery slime for the rest of their lives. It's the same thing with the Lion King. Why should the hyenas have a shitty life? History is written by the victors, so forgive me if I don't trust some P90X Sea King smear campaign against the radical fatty in the next grotto. Okay, let's just go all the way through. Morla, the aged one from The Neverending Story, a depressed turtle who's so fat and dirty people literally get her confused with a mountain. Auntie Shrew. I guess it's forgivable that one of the secondary antagonists of The Secret of Nim is a shrieking shrew of a woman who is also a literal shrew named Auntie Shrew, because the hero of the movie is also a lady and she is strong and brave. But seriously, Auntie Shrew, thanks for giving her a pinwheel of snaggle fangs to go with the cornucopia of misogynist stereotypes she calls a personality. Mrs. Potts, question. How come, when they turn back into humans at the end of Beauty and the Beast, Chip is a 4-year-old boy, but his mother, Mrs. Potts, is 107? Perhaps you're thinking, Lindy, you are remembering it wrong. That kindly white-haired, snowman-shaped Mrs. Doubtfire situation must be Chip's grandmother. Not so, champ. She's his mom. Look it up. She gave birth to him 4 years ago. Also, where is Chip's dad? Could you imagine being a 103-year-old single mom? As soon as you become a mother, apparently, you are instantly interchangeable with the oldest woman in the world. And or 16 ounces of boiling brown water with a hat on it. Take a sec and contrast Mrs. Potts's literally spherical body with the cut diamond abs of King Triton, father of seven. The Trunch Bowl from Matilda. Okay, sure. The Trunch Bowl is a bitter, intractable, sadistic she-monster who doesn't even feel a shred of fat solidarity with Bruce Bogtrotter. Seriously, Trunch? But can you imagine being the Trunch Bowl and growing up with Miss Effing Honey? The world is not kind to big, ugly women. Sometimes bitterness is the only defense. And that's it. Taken in aggregate, here is what I learned in my childhood about my personal and professional potential. I could not claim any sexual agency unless I forced myself upon a genteel frog, or unless, as part of a jewel caper, I was trying to seduce a base, horny fool such as a working-class rhinoceros. And if I insisted on broadcasting my sexuality anyway, I would be exiled to a sea cave to live eternally in a dank garden of worms, hoping that a gullible hot chick might come along once in a while so I could grift her out of her sexy voice, even though my voice was already better. Even in those rare scenarios, my sexuality would still be a joke, an oddity, or a menace. I could potentially find chaste comical romance, provided I located a chubby simpleton who looked suspiciously like myself without a hair bow, and the rest of humanity would breathe a secret sigh of relief that the two of us were removing ourselves from the broader gene pool. Or I could succumb to the lifetime of grinding pain and resentment and transform into a hideous beast who makes herself feel better by locking helpless children in the knife closet. Mother or monster? Okay, little girl, choose. That's that chapter. Thank you. You guys are nice.
That's it for this podcast of a talk by Lindy West on Speakers Forum. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you again to Anna Sophia Knauf for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.